All right, 2 Samuel chapter 19, we're going to start reading in verse 9 in just a moment. We're going to try to make our way all the way through the end of this chapter. So what we've seen to this point, King David has been, remember, it was because of his sin that he was under God's judgment to a certain point. Also, Absalom had made some horrible decisions, and Absalom paid for those decisions. He was put to death. And so for the last little while now, King David has been living in exile. He had become unpopular in Israel. They wanted him out. He fled, and he had been deplatformed. He had lost his Facebook account. He had lost an election to Absalom, but it turns out that there was some fraud involved, and so now he's coming home to be reinstated. And it was not, however, a smooth transition for King David to come back home and regain his kingship. I've entitled our message today, The King Comes Home. And we're going to see, as David comes home, that he is greeted by several people, several groups of people, individuals. And it's a difficult transition, but it becomes a very glorious day for King David. He has joy about it. And so let's read 2 Samuel chapter 19, verses 9 and 10 to start. It says this, "And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'The king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. And Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing the king back?'" And so some time now has passed, and some people are kind of looking around, wondering, I don't know what's going on. Who's our king? Absalom came in, and he was our king, but he's dead. Who should be the king but our rightful king? And David had been duly appointed and anointed by God. He was the rightful king. Absalom was a fake king. He came to the throne illegitimately, but God has put him down. He has been judged. And so who now is going to be our king? There's nobody else. But it's got to be King David. We need to bring him back. But how come nobody's talking about bringing him back? And so that's the question they're asking. And as we walk through the rest of this chapter, I want to divide our time up into five thoughts. As David comes home, he gets some different receptions. So first of all, I want to look at David's return. And I'm going to subtitle this, An Olive Branch for Healing. David comes back and he offers the nation an olive branch because he cares more about the unification and bringing the nation back together and healing than he does about his own druthers and so forth. So 2 Samuel 19, look at verse 11. It says, "And King David sent to Zadok and to Abiathar the priests, saying, 'Speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, Why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel is come to the king, even to his house? Ye are my brethren, ye are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore then are ye the last to bring back the king? And say ye to Amasa, Art thou not of my bone and of my flesh? God do so to me and more also, if thou be not captain of the host before me continually in the room of Joab.' And he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word unto the king, 'Return thou and all thy servants.' So the king returned and came to Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to conduct the king over Jordan." And so David is speaking to, there, by the way, the kingdom is not yet divided into the northern tribes and the southern tribes. That will happen after King Solomon. But it began to be a little bit divided right after Saul died. And King David reigned over Judah in the south, but the 10 northern tribes, Ishbosheth was there. And so we've seen this division, and that division continues here. That David is now speaking to the southern tribe of Judah. He is from the tribe of Judah. This is his hometown, so to speak. And he says, the northern tribes are already starting to talk about bringing me back. Why are you the last to bring back the king? They should have been the first. He's of their tribe. But they had turned on him and embraced Absalom. By the way, Absalom was also from their tribe. Absalom was the son of David. He was also from Jerusalem. And remember when King David became the king, where did he first become king? He was anointed king in Hebron. And he reigned there for 7 years before he was made king over all Israel. And that's the very town that Absalom used for his overthrow. He said, Absalom reigneth in Hebron. This is where David was the most accepted, the most popular. The first people that made him king and anointed him were the people in Hebron. They were also the first to turn against him and embrace Absalom. And now they are among the last to bring him back. They've got it flipped. He is from Hebron area. He is from Judah. They should have been more eager to accept him. And so they finally decide to bring him back. And as a response, David does an amazing thing. An act of humility, we could say. An act of deference. This olive branch that he hands to the northern tribes and to the people of Israel. That he institutes Amasa as their the military leader, the commanding general, to replace Joab. So a couple of things he's doing there. One is that Joab has been insubordinate. David said, save Absalom alive. Joab says, no way, I'm going to kill him. And then I'm going to give the king grief about it. And so Joab, David's going to put him away for his insubordination and replace him with Amasa. Interesting. Why Amasa? Why doesn't he replace him with someone like Joab's brother, Abishai? He's a good, he had divided the army into different sections and Abishai had led a section. Why doesn't he replace Joab with Abishai? You say, well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. He's his brother. He will stand up for him and so forth. But he chooses Amasa. Who was Amasa? Two things I want to say about him. First of all, he was also a close relative of David. He was a nephew of David, and Joab and Abishai and Asahel were also nephews of David, but from another sibling. These are from, David, by the way, has two sisters. Zeruiah is one of his sisters, and her children are Joab and his brothers. And then he has another sister, and we read about her in 2 Samuel 17 and verse 25. So let's, her name's Abigail, by the way. David has a wife named Abigail. He also has a sister named Abigail. 2 Samuel 17, 25, it says, and Absalom made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab, which Amasa was a man's son whose name was Ithra, an Israelite, that went into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister to Zeruiah, Joab's mother. So we know that Zeruiah is David's sister and Abigail is also David's sister. So Amasa is, first thing I want to say about him is that he is the nephew. He's his nephew. He's the son of his sister. But the second thing I want to say about Amasa is that Amasa was involved in the rebellion. Amasa was the leader of the troops that went to kill David. And why would David pick Amasa to now lead his army? Say, well, because he had a problem with Joab. Why didn't he have a problem with Amasa? Amasa was out to kill him, not just out to kill his son. But what David is doing here is that Amasa, he's kind of looking the other way on this day, on that coup attempt. And he's saying, I have faith that everyone, now that Absalom is dead, that everyone will unite under my authority again. And to help unify people, he says, I'm going to take Amasa, whom ye looked up to. You followed him into battle, and I'm going to set him over the army. And he's kind of uniting everyone together by crossing the aisle, crossing the political aisle, if we can put it that way. And so Amasa, he had been a traitor just like Absalom was, but David is in a very forgiving mode here. And we're going to see this all throughout this chapter, that David is not settling scores. He's not taking names. He's not finding all of his enemies and having them put to death. In fact, he puts no one to death. Amasa here could have been put to death for his part with Absalom. But David is bringing back the people with joy. And so he extends an olive branch to show that a sign of good faith that he wants to unite everyone together. Number two, so first of all, we see David's return, an olive branch for healing. Number two, I want to look at Shimei's welcome. And I've subtitled this an apology for hatred. If you remember the story, when David was fleeing from Absalom, he was, you know, crossing the Jordan River, and he and his army were making their way out, and Shimei met them. He's from the house of Saul, and he was cursing at them. He was cursing David. He was saying, now the kingdom of Saul is going to come back, and get out of here, David, you old blankety blank so-and-so. He's spitting at him. He's casting dust. He's throwing rocks. So he's not only cursing the king, strictly forbidden under the Old Testament law, thou shalt not curse the ruler of thy people. He's not only cursing the king, but he is seeking to assault them, throwing rocks at David and at his men. And Abishai said, hey, let me go and take off Shimei's head. And David says, no, just let him curse. Maybe God will bless me for his cursing. So that's the backstory. And now David comes back, and here comes Shimei again, with this time with his tail tucked between his legs. So let's read about it in verse 16. It says, and Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, which was of Bahurim, hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. Notice, he's doing it very quickly. He's going to try to get in David's good graces again, if he ever was. Verse 17, and there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons, and his 20 servants with him, and they went over Jordan before the king. And there went over a ferry boat to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was come over Jordan. And he said unto the king, let not my Lord impute iniquity unto me, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely the day that my Lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. For thy servant doth know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I am come the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my Lord the king. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? And David said, what have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah, that ye should this day be adversaries unto me? Shall there any man be put to death this day in Israel? For do not I know that I am this day king over Israel? Therefore the king said unto Shimei, thou shalt not die. And the king swore unto him. Now, we've already mentioned what Shimei had done, his offenses. It's true that what Shimei did was worthy of death. And so Abishai calls for his death twice. He called for it the day it happened, and he calls for it on the day that he comes back and grovels at David's feet. And yes, he was deserving of great punishment. He was deserving of death. He had not only cursed the king, but he had tried to assault the king, publicly ridiculing his army and so forth. This was not just an accident. This, you know, the way that Shimei puts it, it's like, you know, David, don't take it to heart. I misspoke. You know, I stepped out of this is not who I usually am. I was just having a bad day. This was not just having a bad day. He knew exactly what he was doing. He, by the way, followed, if you trace the places that it mentions, he followed David and his army for 30 miles as they flee, and 30 miles along the way, he's cursing and yelling and throwing rocks. So this was not just an aberration, something out of norm. This was very well thought out and carried out. But David on this day was not in the mood for executions. He was not feeling vengeful at all. He says, don't I know this day that I am become king, that I am king? God is reinstating me. This is a day of joy, not of settling scores and getting even. And so David is very forgiving on this day, a great example to us. So Abishai wanted to put him to death. And the reason is that Abishai always wanted to put people to death. He was always calling for vengeance and justice. He was there the first time with Shimei. He's there now. He was there when King Saul was chasing David. David, I'll smite him to the ground. And I think Abishai was there, by the way, both times with Saul. Multiple times, many times, Abishai says, David, let me kill somebody. Let me get vengeance. Let me take justice into my own hands. And Abishai is always calling for that. By the way, imagine if this were to happen, that every time somebody did wrong, they got what they deserved. There wouldn't be anyone left on the earth. God would destroy all of us. And instead of being like Abishai, we should be more like David here. We should be more like God, honestly. Willing to overlook a wrong that is done to us personally. The Bible says that love covers the multitude of sins. It says it's the glory of a king to pass over a transgression, which is what David is doing here. People like Abishai, they've got to get even. Justice has to be done now. We need to do it. But that's not the way that God is. And David's following God's steps here. Listen to James 2:13. Here's what happens if we want to be like Abishai. Nobody does something to me like that and gets away with it. He's going to get what's coming to him. Well, he may. But here's what the Bible says about that person. James 2 verse 13. For he shall have judgment without mercy that hath showed no mercy. And mercy rejoiceth against judgment. People that go out and they're always seeking to judge people for what they've done, that might work at that time, but God says it'll come back around. And you'll have an opportunity that someone could show you mercy, but they won't, because the law of sowing and reaping will come forth. Listen to Matthew 26, verses 51 and 52. Jesus is about to be crucified, led away to be crucified, and Peter grabs a sword and he tries to kill Malchus. Malchus, dodges or ducks, and Peter only gets his ear, cuts off his ear. Jesus says an interesting thing to Peter, Matthew 26, 51. And behold, one of them, which were with Jesus, this is Peter, stretched out his hands and drew his sword and struck a servant of the high priest and smote off his ear. Then said Jesus unto him, put up again thy sword into his place. For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. If you're looking to mete out judgment all the time, Jesus says, all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. We should respond with understanding, with love, forgiveness. And that's what David does with Shimei on this day. By the way, whenever we sin against God, this is the same type of situation. We're just like Shimei was. We say, well, Shimei, it wasn't an accident. He knew what he was doing. Same thing with us. Whenever we sin against God, we know what we are doing. We are actively rebelling against God. If I can put it this way, we're cursing God in our hearts. We wish that God's rules weren't in place. We wish that God weren't a God of justice. We don't want his rule over us. And so we cast him off. And it's really a form of blasphemy. All disobedience anytime that we sin. And whenever we sin, it's always because it comes from inside of us. Remember what Jesus said one time, that from within, out of the heart of man, come adulteries and evil speakings and so forth. Everything that we do, it comes from our heart. We can't blame someone else. Well, they tempted me. They did. No, we sin because we are wicked. All we like sheep have gone astray. We're all wicked on the inside. And at those moments, aren't you thankful that God doesn't give us what we deserve? Listen to Psalm 103 and verses 10 through 12, a beautiful passage. It says, he hath not dealt with us after our sins, nor rewarded us according to our iniquities. For as the heaven is high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward them that fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far hath he removed our transgressions from us. If you're alive today, if you're watching this today, you're alive because of the mercy, the long suffering, even the forgiveness of God. And we ought to take that and be able to show that to other people. Import that mercy and then export it to someone else's life. And so David is welcomed home by Shimei, an apology for his hatred, and David accepts it. Number three, let's go on. Someone else comes and welcomes David home, and this is Mephibosheth. Number three, we see Mephibosheth's welcome, which I'm going to subtitle Joy Despite Slander. Remember the story of Mephibosheth. David went and rescued him one day from a place called Lodabar. He was in hiding. He thought the king was after him to kill him. Turns out the king wanted to bless him and promote him, and he went from rags to riches. He restored all the land of Saul to him. He brought him to his own table, let him eat at the king's table like one of the king's sons. But then, when David fled, Ziba, his servant, slandered him. He said, I'm going to leave Mephibosheth behind, and I'm going to tell David that he doesn't want to come and support David, that he wants to be restored. He wants the kingdom of Saul to be restored and so forth. And so he lies about him. And David says to Ziba, okay, fine, I transfer it all over. Everything that I gave to Mephibosheth, I now give to you. So now David comes back, and here comes Mephibosheth, having been slandered, having been lied about to David. So let's pick it up in verse 24, 2 Samuel 19:24. It says, and Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and had neither dressed his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes, from the day the king departed until the day he came again in peace. So before Mephibosheth got close, if you couldn't see him yet, you could smell him. He hasn't taken a shower or washed his clothes in all this time, and he's smelling pretty ripe. But why did he do this? He did this to show that he was in exile himself, so to speak. While David was in exile, in his heart, he was in exile. And so he wanted to live like that, to show King David that it was not in his heart to rejoice over his calamity. Verse 25, and it came to pass, when he was come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said unto him, wherefore wentest not thou with me, Mephibosheth? And he answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For thy servant said, I will saddle me an ass, that I may ride thereon and go to the king, because thy servant is lame. And he hath slandered thy servant unto my lord the king. And then notice what he says. But my lord the king is as an angel of God. Do therefore what is good in thine eyes. For all of my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet didst thou set thy servant among them that did eat at thine own table. What right, therefore, have I yet to cry any more unto the king? And the king said unto him, why speakest thou any more of thy matters? I have said, thou and Ziba divide the land. And Mephibosheth said unto the king, yea, let him take all, for as much as my lord the king is come again in peace unto his own house. So Mephibosheth here is a beautiful picture of a Christian. This is the attitude that all Christians should have. You say, well, I don't know about that. Mephibosheth's got a, he left stuff on the table, literally. He should have stood up for his own rights. He said, he lied about me. I want that back. You gave me that land and he lied and got it. I want it back. But he doesn't demand anything. He says, David, you do whatever you want to do. Because this all started with you. You came and blessed me out of nowhere. You made me like one of your sons. And now you're home in peace. That's all that I need. I don't even need, and by the way, David says an interesting thing. He says, I have said to Ziba, thou and Ziba divide the land. David had never said that. He's just bringing that out all of a sudden. He had said, Ziba, you take everything. And now he says, I've said, just split it 50-50. And, you know, just go your merry way. So why does David do this? We'll come back to Mephibosheth in just a moment. Why does David do this? It seems like he is misguided. Like the decision that he's making, David should have not only taken the stuff from Ziba and given all of it back to Mephibosheth, but not only that, he probably should have punished Ziba. I think the reason David does this is that he's gracious to Ziba, and he does give stuff back to Mephibosheth as well. He splits it. I believe that David is bending over backwards to make sure that he doesn't judge and he's not negative to anyone on this day. He wants this day to be a very positive day that's just filled with blessing and joy. That's what's in David's heart. It seems like Mephibosheth is mistreated, but notice Mephibosheth says, I don't even want that. Let Ziba keep all of it. I'm just glad that the king has returned home. And notice what he says. He talks about rights. Some people would say, oh, he needs to demand his rights. That was his stuff that was taken away. But here's what Mephibosheth said. Whose stuff is it? Yes, it's mine. But where did it come from? It came from David. It was free to me from David. And he says, I don't have any right to demand anything of the king. What right have I to cry any more unto the king? I'm just glad that the king is home. Let Ziba take everything. Wow. If we could import that kind of security into our lives, that kind of deference and selflessness into our lives, that would change our churches. It would change our families. It would change our individual lives. So many Christians today are walking around miserable. Why are they miserable? Name it. The list goes on and on. You say, hey, how you doing? Oh, how much time do you have? This is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong. And by saying that, by complaining about wrongs, under the undertone is this. I deserve better than this. And Mephibosheth says, I don't deserve anything. I don't have any right to demand anything. Everything I have was undeserved. That's true of us as Christians. Everything we have is undeserved. We are all doing better than we deserve. Stop complaining. If we ever complain, it's because we feel we're doing worse than we deserve. We should be overjoyed. My cup runneth over. I'm doing much better. And we could be homeless. We could lose our jobs. Our whole family could die. Everything could be horrible. And we could, like Job, bow our heads and worship God and say, I came naked from my mother's womb. I had nothing. Everything, you know, that sometimes people talk about the cherry on top. Everything is the cherry on top. We don't deserve anything from God. We deserve hell. That's it. But God has blessed us with so much. And woe unto us if we complain about anything in life. And I'm not lifting myself up above other people. I have things that I complain about. But woe unto us for being so ungrateful to God for all he's done and thinking, I deserve this and this and this even more. Mephibosheth gives us a great attitude. He has joy despite slander. And no matter what people do to you, no matter what people say to you, no matter what God allows to happen to you in your life, you should be able to have joy if you're a Christian because you're saved. You're redeemed from hell and nothing can take that away. You might be able to lose a lot of stuff. You can't lose your soul. You can't lose heaven. And so Mephibosheth here is the real star of this day. He really knocks it out of the park. A great example to us of what a Christian should be like. Let's go on. Number four, there's another person that comes and welcomes David home. And he is an ill-known person, little-known person in the Bible. But his name is Barzillai. And this is Barzillai's welcome. I've subtitled this, A Deferred Reward. Barzillai comes home. And let's read about his story starting in verse 31. 2 Samuel 19:31. And Barzillai, the Gileadite, came down from Rogelim and went over Jordan with the king to conduct him over Jordan. Now Barzillai was a very aged man, even 80 years old. He's 80 years old. And he had provided the king of sustenance while he lay at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. Barzillai was wealthy. He was a well-to-do man. And when David had fled, he had sustained him. He had given him all that he needed. Verse 33. And the king said unto Barzillai, come thou over with me, and I will feed thee with me in Jerusalem. And Barzillai said unto the king, how long have I to live that I should go up with the king unto Jerusalem? I'm this day 80 years old, and can I discern between good and evil? Can thy servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any more the voice of singing men and singing women? Wherefore then should thy servant be yet a burden unto my lord the king? Thy servant will go a little way over Jordan with the king. And why should the king recompense at me with such a reward? Let thy servant, I pray thee, turn back again, that I may die in mine own city and be buried by the grave of my father and of my mother. But behold, thy servant Kimham, let him go over with my lord the king, and do to him what shall seem good unto thee. And the king answered, Kimham shall go over with me, and I will do to him that which shall seem good unto thee. And whatsoever thou shalt require of me, that will I do for thee. And all the people went over Jordan, and when the king was come over, the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned unto his own place. Barzillai was a very wealthy man. He was well-to-do, but he was aging. He was getting older. He's now 80 years old. And when David offers to reward him for his generosity, say, why don't you come, just leave everything at home and just come and be part of my household. I'll feed you. I'll take care of you for the rest of your life. And he says, David, look at me. I'm really old. I can't hear well anymore. I can't even taste what I eat. My mind is going. He says, can I discern between good and evil? I'm not even all there. I'm becoming senile. I'm content just to be at home and live out my days in obscurity. You know, he's got all that he needs. He's not going to starve to death. But he's not a famous man. He's not a celebrity. He says, but I just want to go home and be with my family and die in peace and be buried where my parents are buried. He just wants to live out his very simple life. And here we find a great example of contentment. So many Christians jump at any chance to be blessed, to have something nice. Hey, who would like this? Me, I want it, give it to me. Oh, I would love that. There's so many Christians that were discontent and were always looking for any opportunity to advance, to get something more. I've got a new something. Oh, give it to me. I don't even know what it is. I don't even know if I need it, but I want it. And we're very covetous like that. We show our heart of covetousness whenever we're jumping at every chance to be blessed. Instead, we should be like Barzillai here, who says, why don't you bless this person, Kimham? Now, who is Kimham? Probably Kimham is his son. And he calls him thy servant. David, instead, here's another of your servants. And he's probably his son, based on what we read in 1 Kings 2 and verse 7. Let me read a verse real quick. This is when David turns the kingdom over to his son Solomon. He instructs him to do some things. Here's what he says in 1 Kings 2:7. But show kindness unto the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite, and let them be of those that eat at thy table. For so they came to me when I fled because of Absalom thy brother. So he says, maybe there's more than just Kimham also, but Kimham is one of them. And he says, I want you to come and eat at my table. And then he says to his son, I want you to keep having the sons of Barzillai eat at your table to reward him, to reward them for their blessing when we fled from Absalom. And so may we be more like Barzillai than like Ziba. Ziba was always looking to get more and more and more, even to lie about it. But Barzillai, even when he had deserved it or earned it, if I can use those words, when he's presented with the opportunity of blessing, he says, no, don't give it to me. Give it to somebody else. And he defers blessing. So many Christians, they don't look for opportunities to show blessing to others. If there's an opportunity, they want it. But the Bible says that we should prefer others over ourselves, in love, in honor, preferring one another. If there's an opportunity for advancement, give it to him. I'm good. I'm content. And by the way, maybe we have needs, but can we have needs and be content at the same time? Is that possible in the Christian life? The Bible says, whatever we have, we should learn to be content with it. God's going to provide for all that I need. And woe unto us again for always looking for every opportunity to be blessed more and more and more. Why don't we look for opportunities for somebody else to be blessed? Why don't even we work for opportunities so that other people can be blessed? Barzillai shows this rare quality. It should be par for the course in Christianity, but unfortunately is very rare. Number five, the fifth division of the chapter, the final welcome. He's got all these individuals welcoming him, and now all the rest of the people are going to welcome David home. And number five, we're going to call it the people's welcome, and we're going to subtitle this a delayed competition. Let's read about it, 2 Samuel 19 and verse 40. It says, "Then the king went on to Gilgal, and Kimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah conducted..." Finally, they were missing earlier, but finally here they are. "All the people of Judah conducted the king, and also half the people of Israel. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said unto the king, 'Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away, and have brought the king and his household, and all David's men with him over Jordan?' And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is near of kin to us. Wherefore then be ye angry for this matter? Have we eaten at all of the king's costs, or hath he given us any gift?' And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, 'We have 10 parts in the king, and we have also more right in the king than ye. Why then did ye despise us, that our advice should not be first had in bringing back our king?' And the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel." Kind of silly here what's happening. The men of Judah and the men of Israel, they've all been dragging their feet. They all should have been begging for the king to come back home. He was the rightful king. It was wrong for him to ever leave in the first place. Wrong for him to be driven out by Absalom. They should have been clamoring, but they took the time. They didn't care. But now all of a sudden, now that the other people are interested, now they want to fight over it. You ever notice people like that? They don't want something until somebody else wants it. You see a little child at his table eating dinner, and there's vegetables. And who wants the vegetables? I don't want these vegetables. And so his brother says, "Well, fine, I'll eat them." "No, you're not going to eat them. I'll eat them." And then they finally fight over it. He didn't even want it until somebody else wanted it. It happens with toys. There's a toy that's been sitting there for a month. Never touched it. But once somebody else touches the toy, "Now I want it. Give me, I want it. I saw it first." "No, you didn't. I didn't." And that's what Judah and Israel are doing. They're like two little siblings that are immature fighting over who's going to bring back the king first. They can all have the king. They can all receive him back. But they said, "You didn't listen to us first. We wanted to bring him back first." And they're very selfish. And there's this competition. There should never be competition, by the way, among God's people over who's going to do right. We should all do right and want to do right equally and want someone else to do right as well. So very different from the honorable men. These men that have been coming back very honorably. Mephibosheth. David says, "Here, take half." He says, "No, I don't want anything." And then Barzillai. David says, "Come, sit at my table." He says, "No, I'm okay." These men are very honorable and selfless. And then they're followed by these very selfish and competitive, the rest of the people of Judah. The vast majority, very few are honorable. The vast majority are very selfish. They weren't just happy to have the king back. They wanted to be the first ones. They wanted to be the ones to throw the party and roll out the red carpet and all this. They brought their selfishness into it. And have you ever noticed this? That people that are selfish just can't help but bring their selfishness into every area of life. It's just who they are on the inside, and it sprouts forth all the time. They just can't help to be selfish. Their lives revolve around them. They mistreat people because of their selfishness. They make selfish decisions at every turn. Their selfishness becomes the defining feature of their lives. There are certain people that whenever you think of them, all you think of is, man, that person's just always thinking about himself. It's always, what can I get? How can I be blessed? How can I be benefited? How can I be the best? And it's selfishness. And selfishness is at the root of almost all interpersonal problems. If we would just be selfless, we could forgive, we could overlook, we could fix anything. But our pride and our selfishness, our me-first attitude just comes to the forefront. Conversely, when someone is loving, love just flows out to every person, flows out of every area of his life. Are you a selfish person or a loving person? And some people say, "Well, I'm loving. I just love myself." Do you love yourself or do you love other people? That's the difference between selfishness and selflessness. This is the same nation, this nation of Israel and Judah together. This is the same nation that a couple of generations ago had rejected God's rule over them. Remember? Samuel, we don't want God to rule over us. Give us a king. We want a man. Be like all the other nations. They cast off God's rule. And then they do it again. They cast off God's ruler when they embrace Absalom and send David away. They reject God's rule over them. And now they're very slow to accept God's rule back. But I want to finish with this. They finally do accept God's rule back. They finally do welcome home the king. They're selfish in it. They're not perfect. But the king has finally come home. He's been in exile. He's been hiding for his life, so to speak. But now his rightful people are finally accepting their rightful king back. And John chapter 1, verses 10 and 11 show a truth about Jesus that parallels David here. David was chased away by his own people, the people of Judah that should have loved him the most. They should have brought him back first. They didn't accept him right away. And it says about Jesus, John 1:10, he was in the world and the world was made by him and the world knew him not. He came unto his own and his own received him not. And so for a while, David's very own people, even some of his own family, it was his own flesh and blood, Absalom and Amasa, that wanted to kill him. But they finally come around to bringing him back. And David graciously continues to trust God and to fight his battles for him instead of trying to fight his own battles, trying to settle scores. David didn't, when he comes back, David doesn't insist on his rights and punish everyone that had thought evil against him. He has the forgiveness of Jesus, who was the rightful king of Israel, but was rejected and put to death on a cross. Jesus did not carry animosity toward those people that had rejected him. He died for them, and he prayed for them even on the cross. He continued to reach out to them. I want to finish with this thought. The king comes home. The kingdom is restored. There's a great parallel here with what Israel did to David, with what we do to God every time we sin. We get God off the throne. God, I don't want you to rule. I'm in charge. I want to rule. I want to make the decisions. And so we cast God off the throne. And every Christian that's living in a backslidden state, what they need to do is welcome the king back home. You need to bring the king back home. He's out in exile. You have sent him away. Shameful. And by the way, God is a gentleman. God doesn't force himself on people. God says, okay, well, I'll step aside. The moment that you desire me back, I will come back. Now, God will rule on his terms. But God is a gentleman, and it's time for us. Maybe right now there's a certain besetting sin. Maybe it's a brief time. Maybe it's been a long time. But Jesus is not on the throne in your life right now. We need to bring the king back home. We need to welcome him home. We need to bow before him. We need to get him back on his rightful place, back on the throne of our lives, making all the decisions, trusting in him. Is there any area of your life right now that you have dethroned Jesus? It's time to bring the king back home. The backsliding Christian, the number one need of any backsliding Christian is, bring the king back home and welcome him with open arms and yield to him, bow to him, whatever he says.